aggressive from the prison. He accepted that these pressures existed. He did not ignore them. Yet he mitigated their effect by prodigious effort. What does this story have to do with discipline? Discipline, in essence, is consistency of action. Consistency with values. Consistency with long-term goals. Consistency with performance standards. Consistency of method. Consistency over time. Discipline is not the same as regimentation. Discipline is not the same as measurement. Discipline is not the same as hierarchical obedience or adherence to bureaucratic rules. True discipline, fanatic discipline, requires the independence of mind to reject pressures to conform in ways incompatible with values, performance standards, and long-term aspirations. For a 10Xer, the only legitimate form of discipline is self-discipline, having the inner will to do whatever it takes to create a great outcome, no matter how difficult. 10Xers are utterly relentless, monomaniacal even, unbending in their focus on their quests. They don't overreact to events, succumb to the herd, or leap for alluring but irrelevant opportunities. They're capable of immense perseverance, unyielding in their standards, yet disciplined enough to not overreach. In our research team discussions, we struggled with how to best describe the discipline we found in the 10X leaders. Most business CEOs have some level of discipline. They wouldn't be CEOs otherwise. But the 10Xers operated on an entirely different level. The 10Xers, we concluded, weren't just disciplined. They were fanatics. Lewis's decision to issue monthly financial reports is akin to Amundsen riding his bicycle from Norway to Spain and eating raw dolphin meat. Their behavior fits nowhere on a normal curve. Herb Kelleher of Southwest Airlines believed passionately in sustaining a high-spirit, fun-loving, and iconoclastic culture full of passionate people infused with a rebellious warrior spirit. Kelleher understood that superb customer service naturally arises when people have fun at work and love their company. As the airline grew from a small Texas commuter airline with only a handful of airplanes into a major national carrier, it would be increasingly difficult and increasingly important to sustain the culture. So, Kelleher himself behaved as a fanatic, exemplar of the culture. "I'll bet you one thing," Kelleher told 60 Minutes, "that I'm the only airline president in America that would go over to his maintenance hangar at 2 o'clock in the morning in a flowered hat with a feathered boa and a purple dress." When asked to grace the cover of Texas Monthly magazine, he showed up in a white suit, zipped down to show off his bare chest. The cover shot portrayed him doing some sort of an Elvis-like dance next to the headline, "Herbie Goes Bananas." When he faced a trade slogan ownership dispute with Stevens Aviation, he met Stevens' CEO not in the courtroom, but in an arena filled with hundreds of employees punching the air with pom-poms to resolve the matter with an arm wrestling contest. On the research team, we joked that Kelleher's technicolor quirks evoked a Hunter S. Thompson quote, with a slight twist: "When the going gets weird, the weird become CEO." Okay, so we see weirdness. But to focus on Kelleher's weirdness as weirdness would miss the point. He wasn't weird to be weird. He was behaving with outlandish consistency to animate the culture. He's almost like an impactful actor who stays perfectly in character while on stage. He was also a complete monomaniac about building Southwest Airlines, never resting in the quest to make Southwest the best, low-cost, high-spirit airline, winning every battle and every war with its competitors. "In my spare time, I work," Kelleher explained in 1987, 7 days a week, usually until 8 or 9 at night. Then he'd settle down before bed to make progress on reading the thousands of books scattered about his home. Kelleher was like Muhammad Ali, combining a deadly serious intensity with a blustery, comical exterior. You might laugh with Kelleher, much like enjoying an Ali press conference, but then find yourself flat on your back if you dared to square off in the ring. By one account, Kelleher showed his competitive ferocity speaking to a gathering of Southwest people. "If someone says they're going to smack us in the face, knock them out, stomp them out, boot them in a ditch, cover them over, and move on to the next thing." Both Kelleher and Lewis, like all the 10Xers we studied, were nonconformists in the best sense. They started with values, purpose, long-term goals, and severe performance standards. And they had the fanatic discipline to adhere to them. If that required them to diverge from normal behavior, well, then so be it. They didn't let external pressures, or even social norms, knock them off course. In an uncertain and unforgiving environment, following the madness of crowds is a good way to get killed. And why would they have such independence of mind? Not because they had more inherent audacity than others, and not because they were more brash and rebellious than others, but because they were more empirical than others. Which brings us to the second of the three core 10Xer behaviors. So now we move to the second core 10Xer behavior. Let's go back to the triangle. Remember, at the top of the triangle, we have fanatic discipline, which we just covered. And now we're going to move to the bottom right point of the triangle, which is empirical creativity. In 1994, Andy Grove, chief executive of Intel, underwent a routine blood test that came back with a worrisome number. A PSA, which is a prostate-specific antigen, reading of 5, indicating that there could be a tumor the size of a sugar cube growing inside his prostate gland. The doctor suggested that Grove's first step should be to visit the urologist. Most people would do exactly that. But that wasn't Andy Grove's response. Instead, he began reading research articles written by medical scientists for medical scientists. Grove delved into the data. What did the PSA test really indicate? How did the biochemistry work? What were the statistics of prostate cancer and the pros and cons of treatment options? He also decided to test the tests, to validate the data in his own readings, sending blood samples to separate labs to calibrate the degree of lab variation in the test. Only after all this did Grove make an appointment with the urologist. But even then, Grove did not rely on his doctors to create a treatment plan. After an MRI and a bone scan, he embarked on a more extensive research regimen, going directly to original sources, culling through the primary data. He obtained all the articles cited in the bibliography of a prostate cancer reference book, devoured those, then searched for scientific literature that had been published in the 6 to 9 months after the publication of that book, and then obtained even more materials that had been cited in those publications. Grove maintained an intense CEO schedule by day and his prostate research regimen by night, plotting data, cross-referencing different studies, and trying to make sense of it all. He learned through his research that there was a raging intellectual war over various cancer treatment regimens. Grove realized he ultimately had to draw his own decision trees, plug in his own probability equations, and come to his own data-driven, logical conclusions about his treatment plan. As a patient whose life and well-being depended on a meeting of minds, he later wrote in Fortune magazine, I realized I would have to do some cross-disciplinary work on my own. After a biopsy, which confirmed the presence of a moderately aggressive tumor, Grove threw his prodigious mental capacity at the question of what he should do next. Cancer treatments usually involve some combination of slicing you up, surgery, frying you, radiation, or poisoning you, chemotherapy. And each option has its own side effects, consequences, and survival rates. Furthermore, each doctor tends to have a bias toward a particular treatment, influenced by that doctor's own specialties. If you're a hammer, everything you see looks like a nail. Grove found proponents of traditional surgery, cryosurgery, external radiation, seed therapy, high dose rate radiation, and combination therapies. The dominant conventional wisdom pointed to surgery. But Grove's own direct engagement with the evidence, his own trees, his own probabilities, his own research, his own analysis, his own charts, led him to a different choice. He chose a combination radiation therapy. In the end, Grove reflected, quote, I decided to bet on my own charts. Now you might be thinking, my goodness, what an arrogant jerk. Who does he think he is to defy the whole medical establishment? But think about it this way. Grove discovered that the medical establishment itself had great uncertainty and disagreement within its own ranks, a dynamic amplified by rapidly advancing technologies. Had Grove faced a broken arm with no uncertainty about treatment, and zero risk of death, he wouldn't have spent hundreds of hours building charts of data. But with significant uncertainty multiplied by significant consequences, Grove did what all our 10Xers did. He turned directly to empirical evidence. Social psychology research indicates that at times of uncertainty, most people look to other people, authority figures, peers, group norms, for their primary cues about how to proceed. 10Xers, in contrast, do not look to conventional wisdom to set their course during times of uncertainty, nor do they primarily look to what other people do or to what pundits and experts say they should do. They look primarily to empirical evidence itself. The point here is not to be contrary and independent just for the sake of being contrary and independent. The point is to be more empirical, to buttress your mental independence and validate your creative instincts. By empirical, we mean relying upon direct observation, conducting practical experiments, and/or engaging directly with evidence rather than relying upon opinion, whim, conventional wisdom, authority, or untested ideas. Having an empirical foundation enables 10Xers to make bold creative moves and bound their risk. Grove's approach to his cancer treatment was unusual, even creative, yet deeply grounded in evidence and rigor. Let's return to Amundsen and the South Pole. In planning for the expedition, Amundsen set up his base camp in a location no one else had seriously considered. A bold stroke that put him 60 miles closer to the South Pole right from the get-go. Everyone believed McMurdo Sound was the best place to launch a bid for the pole. It had been used by other explorers and had proven to be a stable place to build a base. But Amundsen saw another option. the Bay of Whales. Other expedition leaders believed the Bay of Whales to be unstable ice, and therefore a foolhardy place to base operations. So what was Amundsen doing there? Well, Amundsen had gathered the source notes and journals from previous expeditions dating back to Ross's voyage in 1841. He pored over the details, immersing himself in the evidence, noting consistencies and discrepancies, and assessing all the options. He noticed something interesting, something missed by others who simply accepted the conventional distrust of the Bay of Whales. See, in the source notes, he noticed a dome-like feature that had remained in the same place for 7 decades. Amundsen concluded that this particular part of the barrier was in fact a stable location. Wrote Hunsford of this decision, Amundsen was the first to draw the obvious conclusion because he was the first to study the sources. He was that rare creature, an intellectual polar explorer with the capacity to examine evidence and make logical deductions. The 10Xers did not generally make bolder moves than their less successful comparisons. Both groups made big bets and, when needed, took dramatic action. Nor did the 10Xers exude more raw confidence than the comparison leaders. Indeed, the comparison leaders were often brazenly self-confident. But the 10Xers had a much deeper empirical foundation to their decisions and actions, which gave them well-founded confidence and bounded their risk. Does all this emphasis on being empirical make 10Xers indecisive? Do they just spend all their time analyzing and not acting? No, not really. Grove took decisive action on his cancer once he'd immersed himself in the evidence. Just as Amundsen took decisive action to land at the Bay of Whales. The 10Xers don't favor analysis over action. They favor empiricism as the foundation for decisive action. Yet despite their empirical confidence, 10Xers never feel safe or comfortable. Indeed, they remain afraid, terrified even, of what the world can throw at them. So they prepare to meet head-on what they most fear. Which brings us to the third core behavior. Okay, just to review where we've been and where we are. We're going through these three core behaviors that distinguished the 10Xers from the comparisons. They're in this triangle, and the top of the triangle we covered first with fanatic discipline. Then the bottom right point in the triangle, which we covered just before this, is empirical creativity. And now we move to the bottom left part of the triangle, which is productive paranoia. In early 1986, Microsoft leaders met with underwriters and lawyers to edit the prospectus for an initial public stock offering. The underwriters and lawyers came prepared to be the purveyors of darkness, to engage in a battle with Microsoft leaders to adequately describe the risks investors should consider. But instead of encountering an overly optimistic entrepreneurial leader who painted a rosy picture of unstoppable success, they met Dr. Doom. Steve Ballmer, then a vice president, reveled in coming up with scenario after scenario of risk, peril, danger, death, crippling attack, misfortune, and catastrophe. Grim possibilities poured into the conversation. Underwriters scribbling away on their notepads. Finally, after pausing to digest all the possible carnage, one of the underwriters said to Ballmer, "I'd hate to hear you on a bad day." Ballmer became the commissar of concern under the tutelage from the grand master of productive paranoia himself, Bill Gates. Ballmer had abandoned his studies at the Stanford Graduate School of Business to join his friend's adventure. As Balmer recalled, he did some calculations about growth and concluded that Microsoft needed to hire 17 people. Gates threw a fit. 17 people? Did Balmer want to bankrupt the company? 17 people? No way. 17 people? Microsoft would never expose itself to financial ruin. 17 people? Microsoft should have enough cash on hand to go a year, an entire year, without a penny of revenues. Fear should guide you, but it should be latent, Gates said in 1994. I consider failure on a regular basis. Gates hung a photograph of Henry Ford in his office to remind himself that even the greatest entrepreneurial successes can be passed by, as Ford had been passed by GM in the early history of the auto industry. Gates worried constantly about who might be the next Bill Gates. Some freaky high school kid toiling away 22 hours a day in some dingy little office coming up with a lethal torpedo to fire right at Microsoft. Gates showed his fearful side in what became known as the Nightmare Memo. In a four-day period from June 17 to June 20, 1991, Bill Gates's personal fortune dropped more than $300 million. As Microsoft stock suddenly fell 11% when a memo filled with nightmare scenarios leaked its way to the San Jose Mercury News. Written by Gates himself, the memo listed a series of worries and threats about competitors, technology, intellectual property, legal cases, and Microsoft's customer support shortcomings. And the memo proclaimed that, quote, our nightmare is a reality, unquote. Now keep in mind that at the time of the memo, Microsoft was rapidly becoming the most powerful player in its industry, with Windows on the verge of becoming one of the most dominant software products ever. Anyone who understood Gates would have known that the memo didn't signal a change. He always lived in fear, always felt vulnerable, and he would continue to do so. If I really believed this stuff about our invincibility, he said the year after the nightmare memo, I suppose I would take more vacations. It's quite a contrast to John Sculley, who presided over Apple during much of its comparison era in the mid-1980s to the early 1990s. In 1988, Apple had a spectacularly good year. USA Today reported, Apple isn't just on the rebound. It's bounding ahead faster than it has since 1983. In each of the past three quarters, revenues climbed more than 50% above the same year-ago period, while net income shot up more than 100%. At this rate, the article continued, the computer maker will finish 1988 doubling both sales and net income in just 2 years. And how did Sculley respond? Did he live in fear that Apple's very success might presage possible doom? He announced a 9-week sabbatical. 9 weeks! To be fair, Sculley didn't plan to disappear entirely for 9 weeks. He'd still attend board meetings, meet with securities analysts, and appear at Macworld, among other activities. Still, it's quite a contrast to Gates's responding to success by worrying obsessively and issuing nightmare memos. That same USA Today article quoted Sculley, quote, I've got the team in place here. Things are booming, so I'm going fishing. The very next year, Apple's return on equity began to fall from nearly 40% in 1988 to 13% in 1994. Sculley had left Apple by that point and turning negative in 1996. Apple continued to hurtle downward until Steve Jobs's return in the late 1990s. Our point is not that a sabbatical caused Apple's decline or that John Sculley was lazy. When fully engaged, he had a prodigious work ethic. Our point is to draw a contrast with the productive paranoia Gates demonstrated all the time, no matter how successful Microsoft became. 10Xers differ from their less successful comparisons in how they maintain hypervigilance in good times as well as bad. Even in calm, clear, positive conditions, 10Xers constantly consider the possibility that events could turn against them at any moment. Indeed, they believe that conditions will absolutely, with 100% certainty, turn against them without warning at some unpredictable point in time, at some highly inconvenient moment. And they'd better be prepared. Whether it be Herb Kelleher at Southwest Airlines predicting 11 of the last 3 recessions, Andy Grove at Intel looking for the black cloud in the silver lining, Kevin Scherer of Amgen putting a portrait of General George A. Custer, who led his troops to calamity at Little Bighorn, in his office to remind himself that overconfidence leads to doom, or Bill Gates issuing nightmare memos at Microsoft. The 10Xers have a consistent pattern. By embracing the myriad of possible dangers, they put themselves in a superior position to overcome danger. 10Xers distinguish themselves not by paranoia per se, but by how they take effective action as a result. Paranoid behavior is enormously functional if fear is channeled into extensive preparation and calm, clear-headed action. Hence, our term, productive paranoia. We're not making any claims about clinical paranoia here. We're labeling instead the 10X behavior of turning hypervigilance into preparation and productive action. Gates didn't just sit around writing up nightmare memos. He channeled fear into action by keeping workspace inexpensive, hiring better people, building cash reserves, and working on the next software release to stay a step ahead, then the next one, and the next one after that. Like Amundsen, with his huge supply buffers, 10Xers maintain a conservative financial position, squirreling away cash to protect against unforeseen disruptions. Like Amundsen, sensing great risk and betting on unproven methods and technologies, they avoid unnecessary risks that could expose them to calamity. Like Amundsen, they succeed in an uncertain and unforgiving environment through deliberate, methodical, and systematic preparation. Always asking, what if, what if, what if? Productive paranoia isn't just about avoiding danger, trying to find the safest and most enjoyable path through life. 10Xers seek to accomplish a great objective, be it a goal, a company, a noble ambition to change the world, or a desire to be useful in the extreme. Indeed, as an overall life approach, they worry not about protecting what they have, but creating and building something truly great, bigger than themselves. Which brings us to the motivating force behind the 3 core 10Xer behaviors. Okay, so let's again briefly touch base with where we are. We have this triangle of these 3 core behaviors that distinguish the 10Xers from their comparisons. At the top part of the triangle, we have fanatic discipline. The bottom right, we have the empirical creativity. And we now just covered the bottom left, which is the productive paranoia. We're now going to move to the center of the triangle with the animating ambition that brings these behaviors to life. Level 5, ambition. At first, we puzzled, we wondered, why would anyone work with these people? They seem, well, somewhat extreme, paranoid, contrarian, independent, obsessed, monomaniacal, exhausting, and so forth. Early in our research, we labeled them PNFs, short for paranoid neurotic freaks. Yet the fact is, they attracted thousands of people to join them. If they were nothing but weird, selfish, antisocial, paranoid freaks of nature, they likely could not have built truly great organizations. So, why did people follow them? Because of a deeply attractive form of ambition. 10Xers channel their ego and their intensity, their extremity, into something larger and more enduring than themselves. They're ambitious, to be sure, incredibly ambitious, but for a purpose beyond themselves. Be it building a great company, changing the world, or achieving some great object that's ultimately not about them. In 1992, Business Week published a special report on the relationship between CEO pay and corporate performance. Dane Miller of Biomet, one of the 10X companies in the study, ranked number one, delivering more value per dollar of his own compensation than any other CEO. And it wasn't just a one-year blip. He sustained a top ranking, sometimes number one, always near the top, for more than a decade in publications like Forbes, Business Week, and Chief Executive Magazine. Keep in mind, the 1990s became the acceleration point when executive compensation began spiraling upward, fueled by stock options that gave CEOs massive upside if their companies did well, but minimal downside if their companies fared poorly. Miller's stock option package at the time? Zero. His employees had options, but he did not. He owned his own equity outright so that his personal fortune linked directly to the company's performance on the upside and the downside. In a sense, relative to business norms, Miller could have been viewed as the world's most underpaid CEO. Yet Miller showed nothing but gratitude, noting in 2000 that his life was dedicated to two things, Biomet and his family. "There's nothing else I want to do in my life," said Miller. "I enjoy virtually every day, and I couldn't be having any more fun or any more excitement about what I do." As for being the most underpaid CEO relative to value, he blasted the idea of granting tons of upside-only options. What's the point of just more and more and more and more and more for the sake of more and more and more? Quote, "What incremental value does an extra 100,000 shares have?" he snorted. "At some point," he continued, "you're just satisfying an uncontrollable greed complex." In Good to Great, we wrote about level 5 leaders, those who lead with a powerful mixture of personal humility plus professional will. Every good to great transition in that research began with the emergence of a level 5 leader who deflected attention from himself, maintained a low profile, and led with inspired standards rather than inspiring personality. On the surface, some of the 10Xers appear to be unlike level 5 leaders. Kelleher had a zany and flamboyant personality who often drew attention to himself by his antics. So did Peter Lewis. In culling through decades of documents on the Lewis era at Progressive Insurance, we came across a range of descriptors. Just plain strange. Oddball. A standard deviation from an iconoclast. A wild man. Eccentric. A frame or two off the ordinary screen. A rock star without any musical ability. No way to jerk his chain because he doesn't have one. These are all direct quotes from articles that we read. Lewis signed his annual letter to shareholders with the quirky, "Joy, love, and peace, Peter B. Lewis." He strode into a board meeting one Halloween dressed as the Lone Ranger, firing cap pistols to the music of the William Tell Overture, an apt image given that Lewis began to see himself as the masked man. Lewis jumps off the pages of our research materials almost like a self-absorbed teenage male who inherits his family's company and turns it into a hedonistic party house in some adolescent fantasy B-grade movie. Yet, despite his eccentricities and sometimes outlandish behavior, Lewis dedicated himself to one goal above all others, making Progressive a truly great company. And he built the company to be great without him. After Lewis engineered a smooth transition to his successor in 2000, Progressive continued to grow, gaining on its competitors, increasing share value, and sustaining a high return on equity. Did Lewis have a large personal ego and colorful personality? Yes. Did he mature so that he eventually channeled his ego into building a company that could be great without him? Also, yes. The 10Xers in this research share level 5 leaders' most important trait. They're incredibly ambitious, but their ambition is first and foremost for the cause, for the company, for the work, not for themselves. Whereas Good to Great focused heavily on the humility aspect of level 5 leaders, this work highlights their sheer ferocity of will. Sometimes the 10Xers painted their causes in fairly grand terms, even while avoiding any sense of personal grandiosity. Gordon Moore, CEO of Intel from the mid-1970s to the mid-1980s, maintained a low profile, despite being the primary company builder during Intel's early growth. Moore, nonetheless, saw Intel's purpose in gigantic terms, recognizing how microelectronics would revolutionize nearly every aspect of society. In 1973, only 5 years into Intel's history, Moore said, "We are really the revolutionaries in the world today, not the kids with the long hair and beards who were wrecking the schools a few years ago." Gordon Moore led with an understated personality, yet built a great company that would play a catalytic role in revolutionizing the way civilization works. To focus on Gordon Moore's understated personality, or Lewis's and Keller's outsized personalities, would miss the point. The central question is, what are you in it for? 10X leaders can be bland or colorful, uncharismatic or magnetic, understated or flamboyant, normal to the point of dull, or just flat out weird. None of this really matters, as long as they're passionately driven for a cause beyond themselves. Every 10Xer we studied aimed for much more than just becoming successful. They didn't define themselves by money. They didn't define themselves by fame. They didn't define themselves by power. They defined themselves by impact and contribution and purpose. Even the uber-ambitious Bill Gates, who became the wealthiest person in the world, wasn't driven primarily by gratifying his personal ego. Early in Gates's career, as Microsoft began to gain momentum, one of his friends commented, "All Bill's ego goes into Microsoft. It's his firstborn child." Then later, after working tirelessly for a quarter of a century to make Microsoft a great company, creating powerful software and contributing to the vision of a computer on every desk, he turned with his wife Melinda to the question, "How can we do the most good for the greatest number with the resources we have?" And they set forth the audacious aim, among other goals, to eradicate malaria from the face of the earth. How do people become 10Xers? We wondered whether the 10Xers had commonalities in their upbringings that might have prepared them for thriving in uncertainty. John Brown of Stryker, for instance, grew up in rural Tennessee, and his family struggled just to have enough food and clothing. Coming from a modest background makes you focus on the essentials, he later reflected. I do know what life is like in a ditch, so I don't get caught up in the fanfare of whether fame and fortune will come. So perhaps someone who rises from a ditch in impoverished rural Tennessee to become a chemical engineer, and who then becomes a successful CEO, develops an Amundsen-like self-discipline to overcome all odds. But not every 10Xer grew up in austerity. Herb Kelleher grew up solidly middle class, his father a manager for the ever-stable Campbell Soup Company. He studied philosophy and literature at Wesleyan, graduating with honors as student body president, and then excelled at NYU Law, joining the Law Review and landing a clerkship with the Supreme Court of New Jersey. Peter Lewis grew up in a comfortable home in Cleveland, Ohio, and attended Princeton before taking over the family business. Furthermore, we found some of the comparison company leaders had tough early experiences. Yes, John Brown had to climb his way out of a ditch, but his comparison counterpart, Leon Hirsch of USSC, hardly started from a lofty perch. With a high school education, he'd managed to run only a struggling dry cleaning equipment business before he started USSC. Jerry Sanders of Comparison Case AMD grew up in a gang-infested part of Chicago. In one incident at a party after a football game, Sanders leapt to help a friend who'd gotten himself into a street fight with a gang leader. The friend ran away just as Sanders threw himself into the fray. The gang broke Sanders' nose, fractured his jaw, cracked his skull, cut him up with a beer can opener, and threw him into a dumpster. Sanders lost so much blood that the hospital called in a priest to read him last rites. In short, we found no consistent pattern in the backgrounds of 10Xers relative to comparison leaders. 10Xers can come from tough upbringings, or they can come from privileged lives or something in the middle. Nor did we find that they necessarily started as 10Xers. Some of the 10Xers evolved, developing their leadership capabilities over time. Herb Kelleher made some terrible decisions early in his career, such as buying Muse Air. Peter Lewis followed a huge arc of growth over 3 decades and also made some enormously costly blunders along the way. George Rathman, founder of Amgen, didn't exhibit 10X leadership genius from early on. He'd been denied admission to medical school, so he turned to chemistry as plan B. He spent 21 years at 3M, highly regarded but never considered a star, according to Business Week, and then joined Litton Industries. He floundered in Litton's chaotic culture of acquisitions and later reflected, "I left before I was escorted out." When we shared the core 10Xer behaviors with our students, former research team members, and critical readers, we received a series of questions. Are the 10Xer core behaviors learnable? Can anyone become a 10Xer? Is it okay to be a 3Xer rather than a 10Xer? Do you absolutely need to be a 10Xer to survive in a chaotic world? Are 10Xers happy? And so on. We understand these questions, but our research method isn't geared to answer them. That said, we believe that you do not need answers to these questions to get going. The coming chapters map to the 3 core 10Xer behaviors, offering practical methods used by these remarkable leaders to build their companies. If your enterprise fully engages these concepts and practices, it'll look a whole lot like a company led by a 10Xer. So our guidance is simple. Get to work, learning and applying the practical lessons of how 10Xers lead. Building a truly great organization that delivers superior results, makes a distinctive impact, and achieves lasting endurance. There are lots of individually successful people, but very few truly great companies that make a 10x impact. Chapter summary, 10xers. Key points. We named the winning protagonists in our research 10xers because they built enterprises that beat their industry's averages by at least 10 times. The contrast between Amundsen and Scott in their epic race to the South Pole is an ideal analogy for our research question and a remarkably good illustration of the differences between 10xers and their comparison companies. Clear-eyed and stoic, 10xers accept without complaint that they face forces beyond their control, that they cannot accurately predict events, and that nothing is certain. Yet they utterly reject the idea that luck, chaos, or any other external factor will determine whether they succeed or fail. 10xers display three core behaviors that, in combination, distinguish them from the leaders of the less successful comparison companies. Fanatic discipline is core behavior number one. Remember the top of the triangle, fanatic discipline. 10xers display extreme consistency of action, consistency with values, goals, performance standards, and methods. They are utterly relentless, monomaniacal, unbending in their focus on their quests. Bottom right of the triangle, second core behavior, empirical creativity. When faced with uncertainty, 10xers do not look primarily to other people, conventional wisdom, authority figures, or peers for direction. They look primarily to empirical evidence. They rely upon direct observation, practical experimentation, and direct engagement with tangible evidence. They make their bold, creative moves, and they do make bold, creative moves, from sound, empirical base. Core behavior number three, bottom left of the triangle, productive paranoia. 10xers maintain hypervigilance, staying highly attuned to threats and changes in their environment, even when, especially when, all's going well. They assume conditions will turn against them at perhaps the worst possible moment. They channel their fear and worry into action, preparing, developing contingency plans, building buffers, and maintaining large margins of safety. Underlying the three core 10xer behaviors is a motivating force, passion, and ambition for a cause or company larger than themselves. This is what we call the level 5 ambition. They have egos, yes, but their egos are channeled into their companies and their purposes, not personal aggrandizement. Unexpected findings. Fanatic discipline is not the same as regimentation, measurement, obedience to authority, adherence to social stricture, or compliance with bureaucratic rules. True discipline requires mental independence and an ability to remain consistent in the face of herd instinct and social pressures. Fanatic discipline often means being a nonconformist. Empirical creativity gives 10xers a level of confidence that, to outsiders, can look like foolhardy boldness. In fact, empirical validation allows them to simultaneously make bold moves and bound their risk. Being empirical doesn't mean being indecisive. 10xers don't favor analysis over action. They favor empiricism as the foundation for decisive action. Productive paranoia enables creative action. By presuming worst-case scenarios and preparing for them, The 10Xers minimize the chances that a disruptive event or a huge piece of bad luck will stop them from their creative work. And finally, as we will do in all of our chapter summaries, one key question for you. Rank order the three core 10Xer behaviors: fanatic discipline, empirical creativity, and productive paranoia, from your strongest to your weakest. What can you do to turn your weakest into your strongest? Chapter 3, 20 Mile March. Chapter quote, "Freely chosen, discipline is absolute freedom." Ron Serino. I'd like to have you think back to the triangle from the 10Xer chapter and how at each point of the triangle we have these core behaviors. Top of the triangle, fanatic discipline. Bottom right of the triangle, empirical creativity. Bottom left of the triangle, productive paranoia. Now, in the coming chapters, especially the next three chapters, there's going to be a direct map from one of the core behaviors of the 10Xers into the way they lead and build their companies. The 20-mile march maps directly to the top of the triangle, fanatic discipline. Suppose you have the opportunity to invest in one of two companies, Company A or Company B. Both companies are small, operating in a fast-growing new industry, spinning out disruptive technologies, thriving on rapidly growing customer demand. They have similar product categories, similar customers, opportunities, and threats. They're a near-perfect matched pair. Now, Company A will achieve 25% average annual growth in net income over a 19-year period. Company B will achieve 45% average annual growth in net income over the same 19 years. So to repeat, Company A, 25% average growth. Company B, 45% average growth. Stop and think. Which company will you want to invest in? Most people, including us, would invest in Company B, given no additional information. But now let's add some more information. The standard deviation of net income growth, which reflects the degree of volatility, if you will, for Company A over that same period will be 15 percentage points. The standard deviation for Company B over the same years will be 116 percentage points. So now we have Company A is 25 plus or minus 15. Company B is 45 plus or minus 116. And let me just add a little bit more. Company A will maintain consistent and controlled growth, staying below 30% for 16 of 19 years, yet achieving 20% or more almost every year. I mean, it's right in this 20 to 30 range, click, 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 click. Company B, on the other hand, will show much more erratic and uncontrolled growth than Company A. Company B's annual net income growth rate will exceed 30% for 13 of 19 years, with net income growth rates ranging from a positive 313% to a negative 200%. Now think about who you would want to invest in, A or B. By now, you're probably suspecting that Company A turned out to be a better investment than Company B, despite the fact that B generally grew faster. And you'd be correct. But the amazing thing is how much better. I'd like you to picture a chart that shows the value, the cumulative value of investing a dollar in each company, Company A and Company B. And on this chart, I want you to see Company A just rising exponentially, almost off the upper right-hand end of the page. And Company B going along the bottom of the page and then disappearing from the chart. The Company A chart rises from $1 at its start to around 350 times that. Company B tracks along, not much above where it started, and then goes poof. Company A is Stryker, and Company B is USSC. Every $1 invested in Stryker at the end of 1979, the year of its initial public offering, and held through 2002, multiplied more than 350 times. Every $1 invested in USSC on the same date generated cumulative returns that fell below the general market by 1998, and then it disappears. For all of its extraordinary growth, USSC capitulated to an acquisition, giving up forever its chance to come back as a great company. John Brown's 20-mile march. Imagine you're standing with your feet in the Pacific Ocean, in San Diego, California, looking inland. You're about to embark on a 3,000-mile walk from San Diego to the tip of Maine. On the first day, you march 20 miles, making it out of town. On the second day, you march 20 miles. And again, on the third day, you march 20 miles, heading into the heat of the desert. It's hot, more than 100 degrees, and you want to rest in the cool of your tent, but you don't. You get up and you march 20 miles. You keep the pace, 20 miles a day. Then the weather cools, and you're in comfortable conditions with the wind at your back, and you could go much farther. But you hold back, modulating your effort. You stick with your 20 miles. Then you reach the Colorado high mountains and get hit by snow, wind, and temperatures below zero, and all you want to do is stay in your tent. But you get up. You get dressed. You march your 20 miles. You keep up the effort. 20 miles, 20 miles, 20 miles. Then you cross into the plains, and it's glorious springtime, and you can go 40 or 50 miles in a day. But you don't. You sustain your pace, marching 20 miles. And eventually, you get to Maine. Now, imagine another person who starts out with you on the same day in San Diego. He gets all excited by the journey and logs 40 miles the first day. Exhausted from his first gigantic day, he wakes up to 100 degree temperatures. He decides to hang out until the weather cools, thinking, I'll make it up when conditions improve. He maintains this pattern. Big days with good conditions, whining and waiting in his tent on bad days as he moves across the western United States. Just before the Colorado high mountains, he gets a spate of great weather, and he goes all out, logging 40 to 50 mile days to make up lost ground,